Thanks, Nick. Hi, everyone. Good morning or good afternoon, good evening. And thank you for talking to us today about IFRS 9. My name's Laura, and I'm on the staff that's working on the post-implementation review. And also here is Rihanna, who runs all of our financial instruments-related projects. So bear with me one sec. I'm just going to get up the slide. Flick forward slightly. Right then. So by now, most companies will have published their third set of accounts using IFRS 9.
Sorry, could I just ask everyone ask everyone to mute if you're not speaking? I think we're just getting some feedback as Laura speaks. So if you're not speaking, please mute. Sorry, Laura.
No, that's all right. I think I've stopped getting feedback now as well.
Good. Over to you again.
Fab. Thank you. Okay, so I was just saying that by now, most companies will have just published their third set of accounts using IFRS 9, and the board has just recently begun its post-implementation review. The board originally developed IFRS 9 in three phases. First, we had classification and measurement, then the impairment requirements, and then hedge accounting. Right now, in this PIR, we're looking only at classification and measurement. So the requirements for measuring instruments are either amortized cost or at fair value, and for determining where in the income statement we see fair value information in P&L or in OCI. So we're at an early stage of the PIR, and what we're doing at the moment is we're speaking to stakeholders so that we can hear their feedback, your feedback, on how well the requirements are working in practice. So have the requirements met the ISB's objective? What's working well? What might have been a challenge? What has been as you expected it to be? Maybe what's been a surprise? All that kind of feedback. And once we've gathered all this feedback, the board will then later use all that information to decide which specific matters it wants to gather some more detailed information on. And it's going to do that later this year by publishing a public consultation document with some of those specific questions. And then what happens after that is the board will analyze all the sort of comment letters that it receives, and it will then produce a report which summarizes the PIR findings and any next steps. There could be no next steps once we get to the end of the PIR, or for example, the board might decide to consider standard setting, for example, maybe to add some additional application guidance, or it might decide to provide some more educational materials in some specific areas. So for today's meeting, I think you can see from the number of slides, the agenda paper has provided quite a lot of support material, just in case you wanted to delve into the depths of IFRS 9. And in that material, we've also pointed out a couple of the topics that we thought might be of most interest to CMAC members. But what we really wanted to focus on and to ask you today is for your views on these three questions that are out in slide three. And then, of course, on top of that, we'd also very much welcome any additional views you wanted to share and any questions you might like to ask the staff relating to the PIR. So how we intend to run the session is that we'll discuss each of these three questions separately, with the staff introducing each one in turn. So then I'll start now with question one. The question we have here is, does IFRS 9 provide useful information about how an entity manages its financial assets in order to realize cash flows? And I guess one thing I'd say is that this is arguably one of the most important questions for C&M. the whole objective of our different classification categories and the measurement approaches in IFRS 9 is to provide users with the most useful information that we can about future cash flows. And for instruments where the entity is simply collecting the contractual cash flows, so such as for most basic lending arrangements, that information can be provided with a simple amortized cost measurement. But for instruments perhaps that have more complex cash flows, or that the entity might have the intention to sell rather than to hold on to, fair value, we think, provides the best information about the nature and the uncertainty of those cash flows. So what we're interested in asking you is whether you think the requirements that we have drawn the right line so that the measurement of the financial assets is aligned with the overall objective of why the entity is holding the instruments. So with that, I'll pause there and hand over to CMAC members to discuss question one.
Thanks, Laura. So just a reminder, if you'd like to speak, make a comment, ask a question to the staff on this first question, please could you just let me know via the chat and then we'll call people in turn. Great. Thanks, Deirdre. Can I ask you to kick us off?
Okay, so I suppose I'm going to speak from the perspective of being a European banks analyst. So I do find the standard useful. Arguably, we had some of the disclosure in the previous version of the accounts, but it is helpful that delineation between fair value through OCI and then having us giving the disclosure of the OCI movements allows us to determine in some instances how we want to think about book value of an entity. So we find that, I suppose, particularly in the insurance sector, we would find that type of disclosure helpful. I suppose the classifications that are there can be very beneficial as well when we're looking at an entity for the first time. So if we don't perceive something to be a large player, we'll say in the trading markets, etc., and then we see an awful lot of assets are fair valued through the P&L, again, that can be a red flag to us that our perceptions of how this business is generating their earnings doesn't correspond with the makeup or composition of the balance sheet. So it leads us to challenge the company and influence how we think about it. I suppose historically we had, you know, available for sale disclosures and we had held to maturity, and it was always very difficult for an entity to put assets in the hold to maturity bucket. You know, the challenge as to being able to explicitly say that you did not intend trading it meant that categorization was largely redundant most of the time. So don't miss that treatment. And I know it's a question further along, but when the standard came in, I did find that entities were very helpful in providing a reconciliation so that we could see how they had reallocated the different assets across or liabilities across the balance sheet. And again, because I went back to have a look actually at some of the old annual reports, and because that disclosure was so helpful at the time and how they did do that very basic reconciliation for us. Again, it gave us an opportunity to discuss with the companies if there was a big switch in the treatment of assets or liabilities. And again, it helped as an educational process, not just from the investment side, but also I think from the entity's side, that they could maybe get a better understanding as to how we were interpreting their disclosures. I think it's useful. It's very helpful for us to understand how the the entities believe they're going to utilize whatever the assets or liabilities that are on the balance sheet.
Great, thank you, Deirdre. Can I go to Flo next then, please?
Sure, yeah, thanks. I mean, I support many things that Deirdre mentioned. To be honest, it felt that the classification measurement, a lot of the classification measurement issues or changes in IFRS weren't that big an issue versus what we had before. So a lot of the underlying logic of what went through what remained the same, although I would agree that the view on business models versus more trying to put down bright lights, red lines somewhere, I think was more helpful. In preparation, I also went back and looked at some of the transitionary documentation, and it was, as I recalled, it wasn't as big an issue on the classification side. So I looked at the names I had. They had like 9 million classification on a 40 billion asset, or 140 million of classification on 14 billion asset base. So it wasn't huge changes on the classification for what we've seen. But I think the way the classification is done and how it runs through the balance sheet and then runs through the income statement, OCI, and into the balance sheet is helpful, and in particularly the accumulated other comprehensive income, which Deirdre mentioned, that line within the equity is a very helpful measure for us to think about valuation issues here. My biggest issue is more on the sort of credit loss type of disclosures, and obviously COVID was the perfect stress test for a very new standard. So I'm not sure if and when we want to talk about that, but that was for us the bigger issue, particularly compared to the performance of CECL, you know, which took a slightly different approach, but to how to solve this problem and how that performed through the last 12 months, let's say.
Great, thanks, Florin. I mean, I think we'll be coming back to that latter issue at a later stage. So just, we are proposing to divide up the post-implementation review into sections. So here we are just going to focus on classification and measurement, but within time, we'll come back certainly to that latter issue. Coy, can I pass over to you, please?
I would like to comment on non-recycling of the fair value of equities instrument among six topics presented slide 4. I believe that the current non-recycling rule that prohibited the recognition of gain or loss on the sales of equity instruments for which the OCI option has been selected should be revised. First, I believe that the OCI option is necessary. There are cases where companies hold shares for strategic reasons, such as business alliance, and Japanese companies have a lot of cross-shareholdings. If changes in fair value are recorded in net income or loss, like under US GAAP, sharp fluctuations in the stock market, like those seen recently, can have a significant impact on corporate performance, and the accounting treatment may mislead investors into believing that the company business activities have high volatility risk. Therefore, the OCI option, which is intended to exclude short-term fluctuations from profit and loss, is necessary from the perspective of long-term investment. On the other hand, I believe that non-recycling of OCI does not faithfully reflect corporate performance. The reason is that capital gains, which are the result of investment activities, are not reflected in net income. One of the most important functions of the profit or loss statement is to show net profit attributable to owners of parent, which represents the source of dividend. Dividends are the distribution of the portion of the result of business activities to shareholders, and capital gains should naturally be included in net profit attributable to owners or parent. In addition, many investors focus on the net income rather than comprehensive income as a performance indicator for the current period. This is because they use net income to forecast dividend and evaluation stocks. One of the reasons for non-recycling is a double counting for valuation gain and loss. But I believe not increase some result of investment activities in net income has greater negative impact on investors than double counting. So I believe the non-recycling treatment of equity instrument with OCI option has been selected should be reviewed. That's all. Thank you.
Thanks, Koi. If we go to Matthias, please.
Yes, thanks. Very shortly from my side, I think Koi also mentioned one point that I want to mention. So in terms of classification, it's really, a very good work. It's clear. I also like the business model test. This is a clear improvement to before. Two points in terms of measurement. The one is the recycling of equity. If you ask concretely, does IFRS 9 provide useful information about how an entity manages financial assets to realize cash flows? I mean, for some equity instruments now, we can really neglect the P&L at all, even if they sell it. So you do not have to recycle it. And this is something I don't understand what kind of business model should be behind this, which cash flows should be collected here, which do not show up at all in the profit and loss statement. And the second point is also something Florian already put the finger on it. We had a couple of experiences now with the first month of application of IFRS 9 in terms of measurement, the impairment topic, the expected loss model. If I look back at the Q3 2020 behavior of banks, basically we're all there. Credit models didn't work, and they in Europe basically all banks applied some sort of fundamental overlay, and it was not at all comparable what they did. I think for the concrete application of many of these aspects of IFRS 9, we still need a bit more experience to get into a stable situation. But overall, my opinion, positive. Positive standard. Yeah.
Thanks, Matthias. And I think that's the view of the board, that we need more evidence experience around the expected loss model. And that's why this post-implementation review is focused solely on classification and measurement. And the board will come back to the impairment issues with as part of a separate post-implementation review at a later date, once there is more information, more experience of how that's playing out. Now, I think Florian would like the floor back again briefly.
Yeah, just quickly, just one more issue. One of the things that we really like in the standard, which was already there in the prior standard, is the level of valuation certainty in terms of level 1, 2, 3 and how that changes. It hasn't been a big issue in this crisis, but obviously in the GFC, that was one of the most helpful disclosures we can get. But I think in terms of, if you think about value in banks from a balance sheet perspective, it kind of differentiates how certain sections of the balance sheet really are. And for that, I think it's a very valuable disclosure. I don't think we get it broken down, the level 1, 2, 3 over the three then recognition categories. So that might be something to think about. But generally, I think that is important disclosure in the footnotes for us.
Thanks, Flo. And let me just go to Bertram before I go back to Deirdre. So Bertram, please.
Yes, thank you. I have just two short comments, but one may be made by Deirdre. So I will not go before her. The other point is that with regard to the recycling, I think this is an issue to be addressed with regard to the ability or not the ability to recycle equity in instruments. There is something I think that should be on the table. So, but I will let Deirdre comment on the other things, and maybe I come up after if there is availability possibility.
Of course, thanks, Bertram. Deirdre, then over to you.
Bertrand, I have a feeling you might have been a little more eloquent discussing this, given it seems to be a hot topic for both of us. But I suppose I just put there in the chat that a key positive for me from the standard was that the fair value of own debt for an institution is no longer reflected through the income statement. And I suppose maybe to elaborate a little more on that, the fair value of other instruments that are going through AOCI, and I suppose I am thinking largely ALCO portfolios or structurally held fixed income portfolios for banks. Again, I find it useful that that's flowing through the AOCI. Obviously, that there's the risk of it being recycled at a later stage, but it does dampen down the noise of what we're seeing in the income statement, and then it gives us the opportunity to overlay on top of whatever reported net income, our own estimate as to what the ultimate AOCI impact might recycle or be crystallized in the medium term. But definitely from the perspective of own debt, of an entity's own debt, it's hugely positive that we're no longer getting that noise through the face of the financial statements. Hopefully, I did the comments some justice.
That's good. Absolutely, Deirdre, and that's good to hear. And I can just see from the chat that Florian agrees with you on that. That's the key positive in terms of that fair value change on debt going through OCI. Bertram, did you want to follow up?
No special follow-up. I agree that it's nice to have the change in fair value within OCI.
Perfect. Thanks, Bertram. And then Oliver.
Sorry, just unmuting. I'd just very briefly, and very much from a sort of non-financial side, I think the discussion has been quite focused on financials for obvious reasons. But I mean, I would just say firstly, I think the classification of assets is helpful in terms of what they're explicitly used for. Personally, I think I haven't found, you know, taking changes in fair value of the equity investments, in particular through P&L, you know, as a long-term investor, I think thinking about the operating business model, sometimes that can be a lot of noise. But in terms of specifically the question on the measurement side of things, the one thing I haven't quite got my head around looking at it is that why, when sort of the available for sale securities or those that are taken through OCI in an equity perspective, you know, once it's sold, it's not recycled back into the P&L. To me, I mean, again, obviously adjustments can be made, and I understand that, you know, the company can choose to take it through the P&L, I think, under certain circumstances. But I personally think once the thing is actually, the asset's actually sold and realized, I wonder if it's simpler and clearer to take it through the, recycle it back through the P&L. But
thanks, Oliver, for those comments. Laura, is there anything that you would like to reflect on there, or if not, perhaps move on to the second question?
I can move on to the second question, unless you wanted to say anything, Rihanna.
Maybe just to ask a general question on this fair value OCI for equities and the non-recycling. I mean, we've heard those comments before, but I'm just wondering from your perspective, looking at the financial statements then, because those equities, there's no impairment model on them. It's one of the reasons why they are not recycled, because, you know, we couldn't seem to have found a good impairment model that worked for that. Would you be at all concerned about the potential for earnings management in the sense that, you know, the entity could decide when to sell the equities and take the gain through P&L, but kept the losses parked in OCI, and so it becomes a bit of a earning management tool if, you know, it's being recycled on sale? Would that be of concern to you or not really?
I mean, I I comment or shall I write?
Yeah, please do. Please. Yeah, go ahead.
I think that's a fair point, actually. Yeah, I think that is a fair point. That would be a, that would, it's a fair point.
Yeah. Thanks, Oliver. Any other observations before? Anthony has a
general comment. I would just...
Yeah, go ahead, please, Anthony.
Sorry, I thought Flo wanted to say something. I didn't have some specifically about classification and measurement, and I agree that we have to do post-implementation review, but it seems to me that the more important thing to review, and you said you're going to review it at a different, at a later date, is the issue of impairment, because we just went through COVID, and I live here in North America, and we have a huge difference among comparability within our own Canadian banks. Comparability to U.S. banks has been a problem and a misunderstanding from a lot of investors. And we're still in now, now we're moving forward and there's reversals and there's other organizations that are taking additional provisions and the disclosures are different. I think the time to provide that that sort of additional guidance and review that is sooner rather than later, because we're still in the midst of this crisis to a varying degree, depending on where you are in the world. And I think investors are clamoring to figure it out. Anyway, just my two cents on what I think is the most important thing to look at.
No, thanks, Anthony. Useful perspective. And I think part of the debate is COVID a particularly exceptional event? Is a normal cyclical development help in that respect, of assessing the impairment model? But as I say, the board has put that to one side, and it is focusing on classification and measurement at the moment. But your point is taken, certainly. And sorry, Florin, please, I cut you off previously.
Yeah, no worries. I mean, all I'm saying on the question of recycling, the issue that Deirdre raised, I think this is actually something that is regularly done by insurers in selling their fixed income portfolio, right? So they do have a little bit of the ability to manage their EPS numbers by selling some fixed income securities, gaining, using gains and losses, but just reinvesting them. So I think the question of, is this an issue for earnings management, is a very relevant one, because I think it's something that I do see happening, not on the banking side, but more with insurance.
Thanks for that perspective. I'm cognizant of time. I wonder whether we should then move on to the next question, Laura.
Yes, okay, that sounds good. So we have touched on in a few comments and disclosures, but I'm looking at question two. What we'd like to ask for your views on is whether you think the information you're getting about classification and measurement is comparable between different entities, and whether the information that you're seeing is what you expected, or whether there was something you were expecting to see but you're not getting. And we do have specific presentation requirements in IFRS 9. But when it comes to classification and measurement, there aren't many disclosure requirements that are relevant to CNN. We'd just be interested in understanding what information you're seeing and how comparable you think that is. So I'll hand over in case members have any comments on that particular question.
Thanks, Laura. So any thoughts from members in terms about the information that you're being provided around classification and measurement? Deirdre, let me hand over to you.
This will be quite brief. I think when it comes to fairly simple asset classes, then comparability between entities is reasonable. I think it's very difficult for us, as external users of the accounts, to determine how comparable or what comparability is like when it comes to more complex instruments. The impression I get, I'm just thinking of a conversation where I had with one entity, and I think it was to do actually with level 1, 2, and 3, where I was challenging how much was in level 2 versus level 3, and their part of their logic was that they were being more prudent than others in the market in terms of how they were disclosing and how they were treating these liabilities. So it's impossible for me as an external user to determine how reasonable that comment is. So for plain vanilla instruments, or, you know, where you just have to think, well, is it a trading portfolio or is it a structural portfolio? And they're simple assets, plain vanilla assets. Yes, I would think the majority are comparable. But once it gets any sort of level of complexity, particularly derivatives, or even repo instruments, actually, arguably, you would think they're quite simple. But I believe, if my memory is correct, it was actually to do with repo classifications where this issue arose. It gets very murky very quickly, and I do think it's impossible as an external user to determine how comparable entities are using the standard.
Thanks, Deirdre. Helpful to have that perspective. Any other views on our second question? If there aren't any further views or comments from CMAC members, here we've got a couple. Sorry, Rosemary, over to you.
Yeah, thanks. Just a quick comment. I completely agree with what Dieter said on the level like 2 and 3, and you know, as especially level 3, the variance in valuations, and I see that a lot in sort of the private equity venture capital, is really quite vast. And so I again just want to reiterate her point that I think the measurement and classification could be, not so much the classification but the measurement, can pose a real challenge when you're comparing financial statements.
Thanks, Rosemary. And I also see in the chat that Lorraine is agreeing with the sentiments expressed by Deirdre. Any further comments? If that's not the case, let's move on. Sue, sorry, you've just. Do you want to add anything, Sue, at this stage?
Sorry, tried to find the right buttons. Just that the comments on the valuation that the last two speakers made were interesting, and just to flag that the feedback about the sort of transparency, if you like, around fair value measurements would be really helpful to get when we do the exposure draft that's coming up in the next month on the disclosure requirements around IFRS 13 and the work that we're doing there to improve the disclosures around fair value measurements. So we might come back and prompt you again following those comments. Thank you.
Thanks, Sue. It's a very good reminder. And I think when we come to our next meeting, which is in with GPS, I think that subject, which is around the targeted standards level of review of disclosure, and particularly how they may impact amongst other standards, IFRS 13, is something that's mooted for the agenda at that stage. But thank you very much for the reminder. So Laura, let's move on to the third question, if we could.
Okay, yeah, no problem. Okay, so this last question we have looks back to transition to IFRS 9, and I know that Deirdre already made a comment to do with those disclosures. So when an entity first transitioned to IFRS 9, they were not required to restate their comparative information. So instead, what the board did require was for entities to provide users with some extensive transition disclosures that year that would explain the changes in classification compared to the previous under IAS 39. So what we'd like to know is, did you find that transition information useful? And did it help you to understand the changes in classification? certification. And I think it would be, you know, a fair question to ask why we're so interested in transition, given that it's a thing of a past for most people. But any feedback you might be able to provide us looking back to those transition financial statements would be really valuable to us, because it can help us in the future with our other standard setting projects. So I'll hand over if you have any comments about the transition requirements.
Thanks, Laura. So just asking those of you who can remember who've specialised in this area of the market to turn your minds back to the first set of IFRS 9 financial standards and how helpful those transition requirements were at that time. Deirdre, would you like to kick off again? Thank you.
Sorry, this will be very brief. Obviously, as I've said, I did find the transition, we'll say reconciliation, useful, but just with regards to, you know, your thought process going forward, the entities that I went back and had a look at, they did it in kind of a, I want to say it's a graphical presentation where they showed 2017 and they had the previous standard classifications, and then they had 2018 beside it and they had the new classification. So it was all in the one table. But in 2017, they would have had grey boxes for where, you know, the previous standard wouldn't have existed, and therefore they had nothing allocated to that classification. And then 2018, they populated, obviously, under the new classification and greyed out the old standard. And just as a user, and this is obviously a very personal comment, but I just found that very helpful and very easy to interpret, rather than restating the financial statements and then I have to go back and read all of the notes to the accounts to try and determine where X and Y moved in terms of income statement or balance sheet. Whereas this graphical presentation where you had the old standard in 1 year, grey boxes for the new standard, then you moved on to the new standard and you had grey boxes against the old standard. And you could nearly, now obviously the assets and liabilities and the income didn't flow naturally from one standard to the other smoothly. Of course, there was adjustments and some assets went to different buckets. But in a lot of instances, you could kind of, just by eyeballing it, determine that, you know, 80% of these assets moved to the bucket and that makes sense and move on, rather than having to spend a long time reading all extensive notes to the accounts. So maybe just something for future thoughts when you're bringing in a new standard.
Thanks, Deirdre. That's good to know. Any other further views around comparative information or restate comparative information and the transition arrangements for IFRS 9? I see Flo concurring with Deirdre's view in the chat. Anything further to add, Florian?
No, exactly. I mean, we had similar experience. We had the similar experience as Deirdre. We looked at the transition, particularly when they were sort of in tabular form, as she described, and then most of the time just moved on because it wasn't a big issue. But the tabular form was really helpful, as well as some qualitative comments on sort of business model understandings, right? Why they moved certain things somewhere and what they thought their business model was for these assets. Particularly when it was around, you know, longer-term investments.
So the combination of the tabular format plus some narrative explanations sounds like it worked well for you.
Exactly, yeah.
Great. Joel?
Hi, can you hear me?
We can, thanks, Joel.
Yeah. So just a very quick comment, actually, and since we're looking at past periods of transition, I actually remember the initial, and I'm going to look at it from the perspective of the impairment issues that I would agree with some of the comments before, that to me, from my perspective, that's the most interesting point that I was hoping to debate, but looking forward to that debate later. But anyways, on the transition side, when the first move from the expected loss model to an incurred loss model happened, And that those transition disclosures allowed us to do pretty detailed measurements of the valuation impact of those expected losses. And I did miss that on when those were no longer a requirement before. So more detailed on those transition periods, I do think that can be very useful for looking at how the market is interpreting those numbers and what kind of impact in valuations though they have. So we have one point in time that you have a very good comparison of the new model versus the old model or whatever you have in that transition. And having those disclosures, I think, is important.
Thank you, Joe. Any other comments on the third question before I hand back to Laura and Rhianna for any observations or wrap up or follow up questions they might have? It doesn't seem that's the case. So, Laura, Rhianna, anything else that we might be able to help you with this morning on these issues?
So just to say, we didn't have any other specific questions at the moment. I think, you know, we'll be coming back to people at a later point as we go along the process and we develop more specific questions. But if there were any views that anyone wanted to share that just didn't come up in these three questions, those would be welcomed.
Thanks, Laura. An opportunity, just we have a few minutes left for any further comments. But I see Jeremy has a general question that he'd like to raise. Jeremy, over to you.
Oh, thank you. So it's really following on from Oliver's point on equity gains and losses, fair value gains and losses, and also gains and losses on... and it's really a question... Under the new primary financial statements, will that line item appear in operating or investing, or is there some discretion? And is it a required disclosure that line item is shown?
Laura, do you want to respond to that?
Rhianna, do you want to respond to that one? Pass the buck.
If I remember correctly, but I might be wrong and I'll have to check and come back to you, but I think the equity would be under the investing category, but I'd rather check and come back to you on that.
Okay, thank you. Thanks.
Wasn't there an exclusion for financials?
Yeah, financial institutions are allowed to include them in operating, which is most of what has been discussed. Is financial institutions.
Thanks, Florian. Thanks, Zach, for that clarification, on that. That's helpful. We've had a number of comments about the expected credit loss model and you know, some eagerness to review that. Sue, is there any further comments that you would like to add on where the board is with that?
Yeah, I will, because a few people have mentioned it, and I think, I think we need to be super careful and to be clear that we are really, really interested in the disclosures on expected credit losses. It's just a question of timing. And as Nick said, we had a discussion about the right timing for the impairment part of the PIR, and we decided that because we are still seeing the effects of the sort of COVID stress test on the ECL model sort of unfolding, and because we are still in the relatively early days of seeing disclosure practices and we're hoping to still see some improvements in disclosures on ECL, and because time series is so important for impairment relative to classification and measurement, we decided on balance that we should wait a little while. And that really, I think, reflects the fact that we think it's so important that we want to make sure we give it its best shot when we get to it. Having said that, I think we are keen to start having some conversations with people about ECL shortly to start getting some initial feedback, both because of the PIR of IFRS 9, which we will discuss the timing of again, I think, in the second half of this year. We'll start talking about when we should do that. So we intend to be delaying, but not unduly. But also we want to see how the sort of objective-based requirements for disclosure of expected credit losses has worked in practice because of this project that we referred to briefly before about the targeted standards level review of disclosures, where many are suggesting that more objective-based disclosures would result in better information being provided to investors. And we want to see whether or not that is actually true in the context of one of the first examples of something along those lines, which we introduced with the expected credit loss model. So please do start thinking of things to gather for us, because we are going to come and talk to you about it. It's just not just yet, but very soon. Thank you.
Thanks, Sue. That's very helpful. And then I see we've got a couple of comments, and I think Anne was wanting to also ask a question about going back to the business model. So Anne, let me pass over to you.
Thanks, Nick. I just wanted to ask members if they had seen the disclosures around business model and changes in business models, which I think Mateus is also asking that same question, because the board said that business model is a statement of fact, and the board expected that there would be changes in the business model seldom. And I just wondered what members had observed over the 3 years. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks, Anne. And I think from what I see in the chat, is Mateus is asking the same question. Do we have examples of when companies have changed their business model? So again, perhaps if I can pose that to the CMAC members in terms of whether you've had direct experience of that, and how that has been in practice for you. As Anne reminded us, we expect that to be a rare occurrence. So perhaps that simply hasn't cross the radar screen yet, maybe the answer.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thanks everyone. Any last comments before we move on, either from Laura, Rihanna, or anyone else, before we move on to our next agenda item?
Maybe if I just finish to share a bit of our next steps and to say thank you very much, because all your input has been extremely helpful for us. So we are still quite early on in our outreach, so we're going to be continuing that outreach for the next couple of months. Some of you might see us popping up again elsewhere. So we'll be doing that for the next few months, and then a bit later in the year we'll report to the board sort of a big summary paper of everything we've been hearing, including the feedback from this meeting. So watch out for that, and thanks again.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks, Rihanna. Thank you to everyone for your input.